Hey everybody, welcome back to Thursday Footnotes. This is the companion episode for Sunday's episode on Uncle Applejack. If you haven't listened to that episode yet, I would encourage you to do so. But you don't necessarily have to. Each Thursday footnote is broken into five sections. They are five things I wish I could have included in the episode, but for one reason or another didn't. Four good sources that I used that are worth your time if you're interested in researching on your own. Three 30-second ads to pay the bills. Two listener questions, which can be submitted on social media or by email at obscurehistorypod@gmail.com. And finally, one quote from somebody involved in the main episode, or maybe just a quote that stuck out to me as I was doing my research. With that said, let's dive into this week's Thursday footnote. Here are five things I wish I could have included in the main episode. There were so many stories that I found of people tampering with Halloween candy to cover their own crimes. Pretty much all of those stories are deeply tragic, and I didn't really want to bog down the episode with just gut-wrenching sadness. However, there were some stories that I found that were not people covering their own crimes, that were slightly less tragic. In 2001, a young girl died in Canada on Halloween. It was suspected to be poisoned candy, but it was later discovered to be an unrelated medical anomaly. Also in Canada, a young lady was hospitalized after ingesting a metal object that was embedded in a peanut butter cup. After some investigation, it was determined that the metal object was accidentally inserted into the treat from the factory. The report did not specify what kind of object it was, though it did seem as if it was probably a nut or a bolt. Number 2. Probably the biggest thing that I left out of the episode was the influence of the Chicago Tylenol murders. According to the Wikipedia, the Tylenol murders were a series of poisoning deaths resulting from a drug tampering in the Chicago metropolitan area in 1982. The victims had all taken Tylenol-branded acetaminophen capsules that had been laced with potassium cyanide. A total of 7 people died in the original poisonings, with several more deaths in subsequent copycat crimes. No one was ever charged or convicted of the poisonings. New York City resident James William Lewis was convicted of extortion for sending a letter to Johnson & Johnson that took responsibility for the deaths and demanded $1 million to stop them. But evidence tying him to the actual poisoning event never emerged. The incidents led to reforms in the packaging of over-the-counter drug substances and federal anti-tampering laws. The actions of Johnson & Johnson to reduce deaths and warn public of poisoning risks have been widely praised as exemplary public relations response. These murders propelled public fear of tampered goodies more than anything else. In the episode, I highlighted the Industrial Revolution and the Civil Rights Movement, but I intentionally avoided the Chicago Tylenol murders because it is such a huge case and would have required a lot of attention to cover properly, and it likely would have taken most of the attention away from the actual story I was trying to tell. Number 3. This is a pretty basic one, but I wish that I could have included the photo of Jack Thompson. In one newspaper article I read, he posed for a photo, smiling widely while holding out an apple towards the camera. It really sells his good nature. He was very understanding of the whole situation and didn't blame the girls for his troubles. The picture is a great way to communicate that sentiment, but unfortunately, I don't know how to make videos. Number 4. Ryan Clark O'Brien is a whole story all on his own. I could have done an entire episode just on this guy. If you remember from the episode, he was the guy that intentionally gave his 2 children and their friends poisoned pixie sticks in order to cash in on their life insurance policy. He made the classic mistake of taking out a hefty policy right before his son's mysterious death. The officials caught on quickly and he was apprehended, but not before destroying his family and the long-cherished tradition of trick-or-treating. He is known as the man who killed Halloween. To quote the New York Daily News, which I am pretty sure is a trash publication, Ronald Clark O'Brien is today remembered as the man who killed Halloween. He earned that nickname, as well as another, the Candyman, by murdering his own son, Timothy, age 8, with cyanide-laced pixie sticks. Although the holiday stretches back to antiquity, children in costume going door to door and asking for sweets is relatively recent, only about a century old. The tradition is firmly established by the 1950s, along with trick-or-treating rose another phenomenon. Panic about people slipping poison, razor blades, pins, and other instruments of destruction into the goodies. Most of these horror stories have been relegated to urban myth. O'Brien is the one documented case that is cited when talk turns to killer Halloween candy. As he took his kids trick-or-treating, one house along the route was dark, but the children still rang the doorbell. There was no answer, so they moved on. O'Brien lagged behind, and then, moments later, came running up. He was waving 5 giant pixie sticks, 22-inch straws filled with flavored sugar. He told the kids that it was their lucky day because the rich neighbors were distributing expensive treats. The kids took the treats home, his son tried it first, and then tragically passed away. Ryan spent his entire life proclaiming his innocence, but he was eventually executed by the state for his role in his son's death. It's an interesting case legally because pretty much all of the evidence was circumstantial, except for the pixie sticks that he had in his possession. But the prosecution apparently built a strong enough argument that Ryan was eventually put to death. And finally, number 5. I also wish that I could have included some history of the trunk-or-treat and the harvest party. These two trick-or-treat surrogates have become a part of the American Halloween tradition in recent years. These traditions are highly organized and seek to give parents and children a sense of safety, often being sponsored by churches or schools. They grow in popularity every year for their convenience and their safety practices. It was a little too broad and amorphous of a topic to include in the main episode, but I do think it's an interesting piece of recent American history. And we're on to our 4 good sources. The first source that I'll pass along to you guys is Trick or Truth, The Real Story Behind Halloween Candy Tampering by Adam Miller of the CBC. It's a great article that gets into the history of Halloween tampering paranoia. Interestingly, though, this Canadian source argues that there have been 4 cases of suspected tampering related to Halloween candy reported to the Canadian Food Inspection Agency between April 1st, 2008 and October 15th, 2019. 2 of those cases were referred to local police, but the CFIA said no illnesses or deaths were associated with any of these events. Tracking incidences of candy tampering is difficult for police, as such behavior generally falls under the criminal charge of mischief and no database of such crimes exists. The RCMP and local police services across Canada, including Vancouver, Calgary, Edmonton, Montreal, Toronto, Halifax, were unable to confirm whether or not charges had ever been laid in connection with Halloween candy tampering. If you remember the episode, I claimed that no cases of intentional candy poisoning have been reported, but my sources were in the US. Perhaps Canada has a bigger candy tampering problem, or maybe US investigations of candy tampering have just been historically subpar. I'm not sure which it is. The second source I think you might be interested in is Candyman, Killer Dad Serves Own Son Poisoned Treat on Halloween in 1974 by Mara Bovson of the New York Daily News. I'm 100% positive that I would not use the Daily News in an academic paper for a source, but for this episode, it did give me some of the grisly details of the Ryan Clark O'Brien case. It's a pretty disturbing read, but it's well written and entertaining if you're the kind of person that likes true crime. Number 3 is an article that I actually quoted in the episode. It's a brief history of people tampering with Halloween candy by Ethan Trex of Mental Floss. Mental Floss is a really good educational blog, and this article is very thorough. It helped me build a good foundation of knowledge on the history of poisoned candy fear. I actually particularly liked the ending of the article. I didn't quote it in the episode, but I'll quote it now. They say, "Has there been anything weird found in Halloween candy? How about pot? In 2000, parents began finding an odd trick mixed into their children's treats. Snickers wrappers stuffed with marijuana. Police jumped on the case and quickly traced the wacky chocolates back to a homeowner who seemed truly confused about the whole hullabaloo. Apparently, rather than nefarious scheme to poison children, it was just regular old drug trafficking. And finally, the fourth source that I'd like to pass along is actually a source that I cannot share with you. Newspapers.com is by far my favorite resource for researching this show. I actually read sections of three different newspaper articles in this episode. I would love to share them with you, but they are trapped behind a paywall. If you have an account and want the clips of the articles that I used, just let me know and I'll share the links with you. But unfortunately for the rest of you, this is a source that has to be secretive. And just like that, we have arrived at our three brief ads. For about 90 seconds, we are going to hear from some sponsors. I know, nobody likes ads, but they help pay the bills. So if you stick around, 90 seconds isn't all that long. And when we come back, we're going to get into our two audience questions and our one very good quote. So hang tight. We'll be right back. And just like that, we're down to our two listener questions. Our first listener question comes from Craig over at Canadian History X. He wrote this question on a Patreon post from a long time ago. I have a Patreon. I don't promote it because I am so unreliable, and honestly, the fact that there are people there that support me makes me feel shame and guilt. The people who support my show on Patreon are literal saints, and I love them all. Craig asks, if you could spend one day with someone you have talked about as a subject on the podcast, who would it be? I think that this is a great question, and my brain goes in like five different directions trying to answer it. One direction is like, maybe I want to chat with somebody from history that I find really interesting. Like, wouldn't it be cool to get Will E. Strawn's thoughts on my episode? It would be great to talk to this regular guy about his life and see if he thought my assessment of his character was correct. I did give pretty high praise for him after only reading a handful of newspaper articles about him. Maybe he was a terrible guy, or maybe we'd be best friends. I guess we'll never know. Or maybe I want to talk to Elizabeth Bathory. Does she know that she's one of history's most spooky and terrifying characters? I would love to chat about her alleged crimes. I think there's a pretty good chance that she was innocent, but I would be really interested to see her perspective on the trial and the whole situation. I think that she would be shocked to know that she's one of history's most well-known figures, and that it's unfortunately because she allegedly drained servant girls of their blood and bathed in it to remain young forever. I think we could add Gilles de Rais into this line of thinking as well. He's also known to history for his weird, disturbing crimes, and I'd love to see how much of a maniac he was. Unlike Bathory, if you recall the episodes, I fully believe in his guilt. From a fanboy perspective, I would love to talk to Arch Obler. I love his radio dramas, and I think that he is an unsung hero of American culture. I mean, he did do the World War II propaganda plays, which I really am not a fan of, but his regular fiction stuff is some of my very, very favorite. He did so much to stretch our cultural boundaries about what we considered horror and suspense and what we could air on the radio. It's shocking to me that he isn't a bigger part of our cultural zeitgeist. We all know H.G. Wells for The War of the Worlds, but we forget that at that same time, Obler had a long-running, super successful horror radio anthology. I would love to pick his brain just to see what creative juices were flowing around up there. The second question comes in from Lisa, from the same Patreon post. She says, I understand that you are studying history, but what's your plan when you're done? Hopefully it gets you out of the closet. She was referring to the old janitor's closet that I used to record in. Thankfully, I have moved my recording setup to my house, and I now record in the music shed that my drum set is in, but unfortunately, I don't have a great answer for this question in particular. I recently graduated with a Bachelor of Arts in History with a minor in Writing. I actually was only like four classes away from double majoring in History and Writing, and sometimes I regret not just getting that double major. It was very, very doable. But unfortunately, situations didn't line up to make that happen. That's fine. I know that I want to use my knowledge and skill set to A, work on this show, and to B, serve my community, probably in the other order if we're listing in them in orders of prevalency. I'll be working in education for my career, but the exact role I'll play is still a little ambiguous at the moment. Ultimately, I love my community and I want to serve the students in my area, but the exact job definition that I'm aspiring for is still a little bit cloudy. Perhaps I'll have more updates later on. All right, guys, so we have arrived at the one solid quote. This is a really interesting one. So there's a guy who has basically spent his entire life like studying Halloween poisoned candy mythology. His name's Joel Best, and he's a sociologist. And I found this little snippet when I was reading a Vice article on the subject. The article says, in an article that he's continuously updated each year since 1985, Best makes the results of his research crystal clear. He says, I have been unable to find a substantiated report of a child being killed or seriously injured by a contaminated treat picked up in the course of trick-or-treating. The thing that stands out to me the most about this quote is that it just seems statistically unlikely, doesn't it? Like, every year, millions of kids trick-or-treat in some capacity, and you're saying that never, ever, since, like, the 50s, because that's how far back his research goes, and my understanding of it is he's been collecting stories and evidence since the 50s. So no time from the 50s to 2016 when that Vice article was written has there been one substantiated account? Like, not even one? It seems so unlikely. And then I started to think about why it seems unlikely. And I think maybe it's a problem with me. Maybe it's a problem with all of us. I'm the kind of person that believes that by nature, people are generally good, right? Or at least I like to think that I am. But the longer that I thought about this quote and this man's research, the more I realized that I think probably we all just believe the worst in each other. Who would gain anything from poisoning an innocent child on Halloween? Like, nobody. Only the most deranged psychopaths. And even they are probably more interested in committing different kinds of crimes that actually have a gain. I'm not an FBI profiler or anything by any means. I'm not a detective or a cop, but it seems like it's a motiveless crime. There's nothing to gain, right? Except for just like maybe sadistic enjoyment of causing mayhem, but how many people in the world actually are compulsively sadistic? Likely, not very many. So the more that I ruminated on this man's research and looked into cases myself with what limited resources I have at my disposal, it seems as if he's probably right. Every story that I found of somebody claiming tainted Halloween candy wound up in their bag inevitably turned out to be a hoax or a cover-up for some other crime or kids just messing around. Most of the time, it's just kids messing around. Now, something that is interesting to note is that he does say while Halloween candy poisoning does not really happen, many children are struck by cars while they're trick-or-treating. So maybe this year, instead of worrying about your neighbor's intentions, you put reflectors on your kids' ninja costume so they don't get hit by a truck. All right, everybody, thank you so much for listening. I appreciate all of you. If you would like to get your questions submitted, I need more. I need so many questions. You can always submit them. You don't have to wait for me to make a post. You can just DM me on social media, which is at Obscure History Podcast on Instagram, at All the People Pod on Twitter, because Twitter won't let you change your username, and I'm still bitter about it. Or even better yet, at obscurehistorypod@gmail.com. This is still and likely will forever be a one-man organization. So whatever you send in, I definitely will read, and I'll respond to it in some capacity, either here on the show, or even if I just send you a message back. I want to say thanks to Ariel Nissenblatt over at Earbuds Podcast Collective for championing this show so hard. I seriously appreciate all the work that you do. If you guys want to find a new podcast, go subscribe to Earbuds Podcast Collective. It's a weekly newsletter that gets delivered into your email inbox, and it's super good. You're going to get a curated list of podcasts in a variety of genres of a variety of sizes. Also, I'd like to give a shout out to Greg at Indie Drop-In. He's a very solid guy and has helped this show more than you guys probably even realize. The fact that obscure history is because of some advice that Greg gave me. So I am forever indebted to him. If you want to find independent podcasts specifically, shows produced by small teams that are not funded by a big network like this one, then you can go check out IndieDropIn.com. There's a few different shows that he has. He's got Scary Time, True Crime, and Comedy right now, I believe. And they're all super good. And frankly, guys, one of my biggest kicks is like the barrier to entry for podcasting is very low. And there's a lot of people who have a lot of talent that are podcasting to small audiences for basically free. So let's get out there and support other podcasters. It's the only right thing to do. All right, guys. I'll talk to you again on Sunday with another full episode of Obscure History. Thank you for listening. I appreciate all of you so much.
Bright room. All the sun. Windows. Windows. Oh, come on. It's in a square pattern.
Months pass with half a year on my back. I'm trading strides for leaps to keep myself on my feet, thinking better visions of what our futures could be. I'm thinking better visions of me, thinking better visions of me. I wrote 14 songs and I threw them all away. Bored to death, can't seem to get myself to sing. It's harder now than ever to express how much that means to me. It's harder now than ever to find release. It's harder now than ever, yeah. With half a year intact, I'm trading scars for teeth to keep myself on my feet. And I'll miss those nights of playing music with my friends and driving 14 days to play each coast and back again. And I'll feel better now without that stone on my back, a burden bigger than my head could under. Better visions of what our futures could be. Make all my heavy mountains fall asleep. And all my heavy mountains fall asleep. I wrote 14 songs and I threw them all away. Bored to death, can't seem to get myself to sing. Harder now than ever to express how much that means to me. It's harder now.